Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we go to the Broken Heart Ranch at the foot of the Black Hills in South Dakota to meet one of the men who raises our food. He's Dan O'Brien, a cattle rancher who's come to believe cows don't belong on the prairie. His book is Buffalo for the Broken Heart, Restoring Life to a Black Hills Ranch. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner rethinks sitting in the kitchen. It all started when Italian cook Marcella Hazan wanted to sit and look out the window while she worked. Then it's A Thousand Days in Venice. Writer and cook Marlena Di Blasi tells of the struggles with love and culture when she follows her Italian fiancé to Venice. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls, and that number is 800-537-5252. Well, Shane and Michael Stern are stepping up to the mic. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, rumor has it you've been in the Midwest.
Better than that, we have been in Yankton, South Dakota. And as far as the Midwest or Great Plains goes, whatever you call Yankton, we have eaten extremely well. And it was actually by accident. We were driving through town just the other day, and the windows were rolled down because it was a beautiful day. And we suddenly, both of us, got the whiff of frying potatoes so strong that the car virtually pulled itself over to the side of the road to investigate.
It was magnetic.
What we found was a place called Fitzgerald Potato Chips, a small house. I mean, I wouldn't call it a shack because it's very neat and tidy, but
it's a tiny house.
It's
a tiny little cottage. It's like
a two-room cottage.
And the rooms are small. I mean, maybe like 10 by 10.
But in this cottage, what they do is make potato chips from scratch. I mean, from potatoes. Dakota potatoes, the woman who runs the place, Dawn List, explained, these are Dakota potatoes which make the best chips. We walked in, and there she was at a great big kettle full of bubbling oil with a slotted spoon stirring the moment's batch of potato chips.
And a pile of freshly peeled potatoes.
And next to the fry kettle was a pile of fried potato chips on a great big sheet that her assistant was sorting. And one of the wonderful things about Fitzgerald potato chips is that the fried potatoes, when they come out of the fry kettle, are drained a few moments and then salted and then sorted. The butts, as Dawn List called it, that's the clumps that stick together, are thrown away. The perfectly golden, round, beautifully shaped potato chips are put into bags and sold. The crumbles and crumbs that are left after those two items are taken out are also put into bags to be used to top casseroles, because after all, what's better on the top of a tuna noodle casserole than crushed potato chips?
Well, where are these sold?
All over Yankton and surrounding towns.
No, the good news is, but frankly, I haven't tried this. They actually have a website, a www.fitzchips.com.
I've never had a fresh salted potato chip right out of the frying vat, and boy, is it good.
Lynn, I just have to tell you how good these potato chips were. It was only as we were leaving, pretty satiated on what we had sampled, that we noticed that they also make caramel corn at Fitzgerald Potato Chips. Now, you have to understand that Jane and I are caramel corn addicts. We love caramel corn. We can never get enough of it. And we didn't even eat any at Fitzgerald Potato Chips because we had so many potato chips. And that's saying something.
I want to get my hands on the seconds, on the clumps that they throw away.
The clumps are great. And they
they throw the clumps away. I mean, the crumbs are great. She said many people buy the crumbs not for casseroles, but to eat them because they're the saltiest, greasiest part of the potato chip. And in fact, the most delicious.
But Michael, they throw the butts away, but they keep the extra brown ones,
and they sell those
for people who like their potato chips extra well done.
Okay, but what else did you find in South Dakota?
We actually found some great food in South Dakota. Where was it? It was the tiny town of Tripp, South Dakota. I think the population is maybe barely into the triple digits. We went to the Sport Bowl Cafe, which, as the name suggests, is a bowling alley cafe with one daily special per day. Lucky for us, we walked in and the special of the day was cream chicken on toast.
Oh, this was so dear. And our waitress had to be 87 years old.
And it was great cream chicken on toast.
It was so wonderful.
Heaven.
It was a food thing you just don't see anymore. It was, you know, like being back in nursery school. And this wonderful old lady who, you know, just had terrific spirit and got so much pleasure out of the fact that we were not from the town and we had come there to eat cream chicken on toast points.
And you eat, you know, right among the bowling balls with a view of the five alley bowling lanes. And I have to tell you, one of the great things is that when we walked in, it happened to be an extremely windy day out in South Dakota, as I guess it is often in South Dakota. We walked in and this waitress, the rather elderly woman, said, you know, they call Chicago the windy city, but I say it should be Trip. And I reminded her that Trip wasn't exactly a city. And she said to me, well, we could be if we wanted to.
I love it. I love it. People knock South Dakota.
I don't understand why. I think it is absolutely beautiful.
Hey, thank you both.
You're welcome. Bye, Lynn.
And happy chips to you.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their Road Food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, this week they left us with a recipe. The perfect tuna casserole complete with potato chips. It's there on the website. Another thing, by the way, to check out on the website. This could be the ultimate chocolate bar, at least for me. It's dark, silky chocolate studded with crunchy nibs of cocoa bean. Kind of chocolate on chocolate. The bar is by this French chocolatier, Michel Cluizel. He actually owns the farms that produce the beans. So look for Michel Cluizel, and this is what the bar is called. It's called the 61% Cacao with Nibs. Now, I know it's around in shops, and you can also find it at the Splendid Table store on the website, splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner is a kitchen designer and a great cook. So when she thinks out a kitchen, she's thinking how it's really going to function. She stops by from time to time to share her latest finds with us. Deb, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
So what have you been working on?
Well, I've actually been thinking a lot about sitting in kitchens. I mean, most of us, when we're in a kitchen, we think about standing and working. But in fact, people have been sitting in kitchens for as long as there have been kitchens. And I was reminded of this a couple of years ago when I helped design a kitchen for the great Italian cookbook author Marcella Hazan. And she said that she wanted a place in her kitchen where she could sit at a table and pare vegetables and look out at the view. And to do that kitchen, we used Woodmode's cabinets, and they have a wonderful table that pulls out of a base cabinet and then retracts invisibly. And so we put one of those in with a rolling stool so that Marcella could just sit very comfortably in the kitchen and work without being in the main traffic area and look out and think about what she was doing. So I was thinking about that, and I was also thinking about people always have enjoyed sitting while they wash dishes. And sometimes I'm asked, when I'm asked to design a kitchen, to make a sink cabinet that opens out completely so that a stool can be set up against the sink and somebody can just sit there washing the dishes. So there's this kind of dreamy, worky kind of sitting in the kitchen that's very old and comforting and traditional. And then the opposite of that is really what we're doing to kitchens today. That is, the trend in kitchens is that they're getting larger and larger. They're becoming prime social spaces and public spaces as well as private spaces. And as a result, people are putting all kinds of seating into kitchens. Couches is a big, big trend in kitchens. And so are easy chairs. And of course, when people have islands, seating at islands is another trend, and it's a thing that's wonderful to plan in a kitchen because it means that there's a place for the intimacy of family life to happen. So I've been thinking about seating places as a way of supporting the emotional life that goes on inside a kitchen.
So what are we looking for when we look for a seat in a kitchen?
Well, I think that we're looking for two things. I think we're looking for comfort, because, of course, if you're going to be sitting down, you want it to feel good. And the other thing, I think, is location. So, for instance, if you're thinking about island seating, to me, it seems to be that the real kind of juice of family life happens around a kitchen island, where somebody is chopping and preparing food on one side of the island, and on the other side of the island, family members are sitting, and maybe they're reading the paper, maybe they're having a glass of tea, maybe they're doing homework, but somehow intimacies are exchanged across that island while people are sort of doing something else at the same time. So I think one of the things you want to think about in terms of location is how can you support intimate conversation in this room where so much happens.
Well, what about the seating itself? Because what occurs to me is if you're going to have, let's say, a stool at an island, you want to back on that stool, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's very hard to find comfortable stools. It's a really difficult task. It's difficult in a number of dimensions. It's difficult because frequently stools are just made in two standard heights, and they're not always exactly right for the island. And it's difficult because it's hard to find a comfortable stool with a back that isn't very bulky and that's attractive and that fits into different kinds of visual styles. There are very, very modern ones and very, very traditional ones and not a whole lot in between.
What about seating in the rest of the kitchen? You know, not a stool, but something that's like a normal chair.
But real seating chairs.
Yeah.
Again, it's such a personal thing to find a chair that's comfortable. And I speak from long experience because I fell in love with some chairs that I wanted for our kitchen table. And my husband sat in them and said, they're not comfortable. And I still want those chairs. 15 years have passed. I look at them. I still like them. But they're not comfortable to his bottom, so we don't have those chairs. So really, you need to find chairs that are comfortable for everyone. And frequently, those are chairs that have slightly resilient seats and slightly molded backs so that they're rounded and comfortable to lean back in. And of course, the best dining chairs, in terms of comfort, have armrests so that you can rest your arms at your sides rather than on the table.
Well, from now on, when we look at our kitchens, we're going to think intimate space. Thanks, Deb.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Kitchen designer and food writer Deborah Krasner is author of Kitchens for Cooks. She works out of her studio in Vermont. Coming up, a rancher who says cattle don't belong on the range, love war and pasta in Venice, and open lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. Dan O'Brien is one of the people who raises our food. He started ranching cattle in South Dakota 20 years ago on his Broken Heart Ranch. And like most ranchers, he's had a hard time making ends meet. Yet, because he's also a biologist, he sees the Great Plains through slightly different eyes. He sees cattle not belonging in the ecosystem. In fact, he sees cattle devastating the plains. Chance and the need to survive had him turn to the animal that had been native to his land for thousands of years, the buffalo.
His book is Buffalo for the Broken Heart, Restoring Life to a Black Hills Ranch. Minnesota Public Radio's Yoon Kerr paid him a visit.
It's early Sunday morning on the Broken Heart Ranch. Way early, just after sunup. Dan O'Brien is piloting his Kawasaki mule down a muddy back road. It's a golf cart on steroids. We are on our way to see a wonder of the prairie. Not buffalo, though. Birds. Sharp-tailed grouse. It's a primeval mating ritual. Wings spread, drumming and stamping their feet, male grouse can do this for hours. So what has this got to do with buffalo? Well, maybe a lot. O'Brien talks in terms of the ecological matrix, a giant jigsaw puzzle. He says the grouse seem to be doing better since the buffalo came back to the Broken Heart Ranch. We take off again. He says a lot of long-absent birds and animals are returning too. Then there's what's growing underfoot.
Just as an example, and the grasses are probably another, you know, there's western here, and there's side oats grandma, and I don't even know what half this stuff is, but there's a real diversity in here. And we'll go to a lot of pastures, and it'll be just like two or three kinds of grass, period.
This land was settled more than a century ago. All of it has been plowed since. So has much of the rest of South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Montana, and points west. Back at his house, the coffee pot rumbling, O'Brien is blunt in assessing the results.
My view is that the northern Great Plains is really an abused and battered land, not only from a physical sense, but from a sociological sense, economic sense, which go hand in hand, from a human point of view.
O'Brien says he realizes this strikes at the heart of two American icons. There's the cowboy, tough and self-reliant, out on the range. Then there's the rancher, harnessing the land through honest, hard work.
But the facts of the matter are that the people on the Great Plains are not doing well and never have done well.
Ranchers exist on razor-thin margins. They have to work hard to keep their cattle alive in the harsh plains climate. O'Brien knows the economic realities. He's teetered on the edge of the financial abyss himself.
I read The Grapes of Wrath again a few months ago, and no one has said it better. You know, these plains simply won't sustain those kinds of populations. So I'm not out to convince people that they should change to buffalo. I'm out to convince people that they should respect the land and should become part of it.
Dan O'Brien raised cattle for decades. From the beginning, he kept trying different ways of managing his land. He was trying to restore the prairie. He moved his cattle around regularly so they wouldn't wear out the pasture. He replanted native grasses. He lost a lot of money. Such was the stress, he literally lost his hair. One weekend, he helped out at a big buffalo roundup on a giant operation nearby. He heard the manager trying to decide what to do with 13 orphaned buffalo calves. O'Brien offered to take them.
So the experiment has been ongoing. It's just that finally the situation was right to say, okay, the missing piece is this big herbivore, which is a big part of the puzzle. And I see it as a puzzle. So, you know, blam, here comes the buffalo back. And the experiment really sort of picks up speed at that point.
The buffalo evolved on the Great Plains. They don't need extra feed and they don't need shelter from the wind, snow, or sun. In the early days, O'Brien was perplexed at how little they needed him. He got over it, though. 6 years later, Dan O'Brien is making buffalo burgers at his kitchen table. He squeezes great wadges of ground meat into shape. These are prepared to the specifications of his partner, Jill McGuire. She's a restaurateur in Rapid City who knows a bit about cooking buffalo.
And as you can see, it's extremely lean. And what we do is put a little bit of Jill's special seasoning with this stuff. And basically cook it rare, medium rare, because it's very easy to overdo the cooking on these things because there's really no fat in it at all.
Moments later, we're out on the deck where the grill is ready. O'Brien's animals only feed on native grasses. They are slaughtered in the pasture by a sharpshooter. It's done under the supervision of a federal meat inspector in the fall. O'Brien says it's much more humane than in the slaughterhouse. The animals are not stressed when they die. The adrenaline produced by stressed animals can change the flavor of their meat. The carcasses are quickly taken to a local processing plant to be butchered. The slaughter makes some people squeamish, but O'Brien says it's an important part of the cycle. He doesn't shy away from the spiritual overtones.
Killing a buffalo is not the greatest part of this job, but it's a necessary part, and it's a part that I actually do celebrate. I believe this also. I believe that all of our beliefs in communion come from exactly what I do with the buffalo. It's the only real communion that there is when you go out and hunt something and put it on the table.
The burgers are set steaming on huge buns.
So, I'm going to try this.
Let's see how we did. Well, a little overdone.
That is remarkable.
It's wonderful. Really good.
They taste very good.
Yeah.
That's important. For Dan O'Brien's dream to pay its way, his product must taste good. O'Brien talks a lot about agricultural models, what works and what doesn't. The model that interests him now is the winemaking in Napa Valley. If it's possible to develop an industry based on subtle variations of grapes, why not do the same with meat? He hopes to convince ranchers there could be a future in grass-fed buffalo. Last fall, O'Brien's Wild Idea Buffalo Company slaughtered more than 100 animals. That's thousands of pounds of meat, steaks, roasts, ground buffalo. It's sold out by spring. The business isn't going to make the Fortune 500 anytime soon, but it's making financial headway. And off we go again on the mule. Jill's daughter Jillian joins us. We're off to herd the buffalo into a new pasture. They're elusive for such big beasts. As we look down from the top of a hill, it's clear why they're so skittish. Each of the dozens of buffalo cows has a small reddish-brown blob at her side. Baby.
Yeah, that's what we call the maternity ward there. They kind of get off by themselves. And
oh, look at that little one.
Now that's a real baby there.
Oh, yeah. So maybe even a day old?
I would say this morning probably. Yeah.
The herd has grown from its original dozen to hundreds of animals, and that's just the beginning. With his business partner, Sam Hurst, O'Brien is now in the first year of running buffalo on two more ranches a few miles from here. Those ranches cover 22,000 acres. They lie adjacent to 4 million acres of federal grassland. It's managed by the Forest Service specifically for grazing cattle. Strangely enough, buffalo are not allowed to run on the land. But O'Brien and Hurst hope to change that. O'Brien gets a little wistful. 4 million acres, space, he says, truly worthy of the buffalo. Dan O'Brien says he still worries about the ranch's debts, but he says he feels whole. Out on the mule, herding the buffalo, he's a happy man.
That's right. Yeah, we got eagles, we got mule deer, we got buffalo. What the hell else does a guy need? Scotch whiskey.
Rancher Dan O'Brien is author of Buffalo for the Broken Heart, Restoring Life to a Black Hills Ranch. For information on buffalo, go to the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org. Yoon Kerr is an editor in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Now, I want you to settle in for a story. Marlena Di Blasi is an Italian food authority, a cookbook author, a cooking teacher, and a woman in love. In her new book, A Thousand Days in Venice, she tells the story of meeting a stranger in a cafe, falling in love, and months later pulling up her American life by its roots and transplanting it in Venice.
Timidly,
Fernando begins to introduce me to one person or another whom we happen upon in the street, on the ferry boat or on the Vaporetto. But this is a place where no one really wants to talk with anyone else. I will learn that those Lidenzi whom he called his friends were nearly all five phrase companions, their affection demonstrated in chance meetings with discourse that opens on the weather and closes with airy kisses and a promise to call. But no one ever calls anyone on the Lido. Everyone with some place to run escapes the Lido in boats each day, as though it were the tenth circle of hell. While those who remain are condemned to swift survival forays into the shops, then back behind the shutters for daytime sleeps and television vigils. Despite the shortcomings of this island, I keep trying to find the chocolate side of the Lido. It should be easy to me because it's surrounded by the sea. I'm surrounded by the sea. But even the sea, with its tempers and complexions, cannot rouse this sandy little fiefdom from its torpor. Except for the beach lady's dance. Until now, I'd spent less than a total of 40 minutes of my life actually lying still under a hot, burning sun. Here, I live in a culture that mandates all females roast their skin. I didn't even own a bathing suit. But once the apartment is in order, I go off to Milan to exchange some papers with the American consulate and to buy an alaya. Bias cut. One piece. Beautiful. If I can't be Italian, at least I will look like one. Tied up in a white pareo, shaded in Versace, a pearly pink mouth sealing my disguise, I wait until 10, walk across the street and out to the sands. And there waits hell's 11th circle. Women lie in the sun and smoke in front of the cabanas for 3 hours in the morning, sleep for 2 hours at home after lunch, return to the beach to lie in the sun and smoke for 3 hours in the afternoon until their husbands join them at 6:30 for aperitivi in the hotel bar. Still at the beach, they shower with a cigarette pinch between their lips. They dress with a cigarette pinch between their lips. And smoking still, they go off to dinner. She, with skin like a crinkled russet leaf and weighted by a kilo of gold and jewels, somehow seems more exhausted than he. And my bathing suit goes to live in the bottom drawer of my bureau. Beach life archived, I begin to think about cooking. In the few weeks that have passed, we've mostly supped early and modestly in the little osteria in Venice after I meet Fernando each evening at the bank. So I set off on foot across the Ponte delle Quattro Fontane onto the Via Sandro Gallo on my way to the Quartiere Popolare, the working-class neighborhood on the Lido. It's there that Fernando says I'll find better things less expensively than in the shops nearby. Now, this is perhaps true, but it is also true that long lengths of hot, sun-licked avenue lie between each merchant. I make visits to the dairyman, the butcher, the fishmonger, the fruitman. And this newly arrived Philistine asks for lievito, yeast, at the bakery. With round eyes, the baker's wife tells me she does not sell yeast, she sells bread. Does she know where I can find yeast, I ask. Yeast for cakes, baking powder. It is this your desire, no? She tests me. No, signora, yeast for baking bread, I say. My intentions cause her chest to heave, and I buy bread to diffuse her agony. So half a day later, muscles twitching from the weight of sacks hauled 3 miles and up 3 flights of stairs, I am sunburnt, triumphant, and I'm ready to begin. So far, I have lit the stove only to brew coffee. I discover that the burner I'd been using is the only one that functions, the others whooshing out mostly air. The single window is sealed shut, and the 12 square inches of floor space invite only a discreet sort of swaying from the waist up. There are no knives. I think about the hundreds of cooking classes I've taught, my bantering on the subject of a well-equipped home kitchen. I hear my sassy self telling the students, adequate space, fine tools, and equipment are fundamental, but if one is really a cook, one can cook in a tin can with a wooden spoon. I was wrong. I need more than a tin can. And much more than this tin can of a space, and damn it, I need more than a wooden spoon. Still, I make a batter for enormous golden squash blossoms and a stuffing for a veal breast with pistachios and pancetta and parmigiano and sage. There will be an iced soup of roasted yellow tomatoes adorned with a pair of anise-grilled prawns to begin, a wedge of taleggio, white figs, and meringues from Magione at the finish. We dine slowly. And Fernando is curious about each dish. You mustn't think I expect you to set a table like this each evening, he says. But I wonder if he's really saying, you mustn't expect me to eat like this each evening. Sure enough, he continues, I prefer simplicity. Besides, he continues, you have so much to do, a wedding to plan, the renovation to oversee, a language to learn. I understand. There is a detour on the way to his heart that totally evades his stomach. But I'm a cook. You can't just tell me not to cook, I wail. I'm not telling you not to cook, he tells me through his teeth. What I'm saying is that your idea of everyday cooking is my idea of festival cooking, he says, as though festival cooking is profane. He persists. The kitchen is so small, so unprepared for serious cooking, he says. It is he who is unprepared for serious eating, I think. And that I would bake bread terrifies him more than it did the baker's wife. Tomorrow evening, I'll cook for you. I can't wait, I think sourly. The next evening, Fernando stands by the stove like the Duke of Montefeltro in purple silk boxers. Bringing out a balance, he measures 125 grams of mezzemanica pasta for each of us. I'm going to marry a Venetian, J. Alfred Prufrock, who measured out his supper in grams. He pours tomato puree into a small, thin, beat-up old pan, rather than into one of my little copper beauties. He adds salt and big pinches of dried herbs that he kept in a tin on top of the stove. The pasta is good, and I tell him so, but I'm still hungry. 3 hours later, I'm hollow with that hunger, and so, when Fernando falls asleep, I creep out of bed, and I cook a whole pound of fat, thick spaghetti. I drench it with butter scented with a few drops of the 25-year-old balsamic vinegar that I'd carried to Venice. I grate a wedge of parmigiano over the pasta until my hand gets tired, and then ornament the silky, steamy mass with long grindings of pepper. I raise the shutters in the dining room to let in moonlight and midnight breezes. I light a candle, and I pour wine. Serving myself over and over again, I devour the pasta. I absorb it, smelling, tasting, chewing, feeling the comfort of it explode again and again. Revenge flutters, and so I twirl it rebelliously, round and round on my fork, exactly the way Fernando told me not to twirl it. Finally, Lucullus has dined with Lucullus. I sit there exhausted, one hunger sated, the next hunger bristling. I've sat still for more suggestions, counsel, and downright direction during this past month than I had during my whole life. He doesn't like my clothes. He doesn't like my modo d'essere, my style of being. He doesn't like my cooking. My skin is too white, my mouth too large. I feel like I've drunk the potion from the wrong little vial. Fernando is diminishing me, erasing me. And I've indulged him. I clear away all traces of my sins and slip back into bed. The stranger never hears my crying.
Marlene de Blasi is author of A Thousand Days in Venice. After that, I felt like we have to try her pasta. She shared her recipe for fresh pasta with roasted walnuts. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, this week's question is, what is a ruminant? Yes, it's something we eat, at least most of us do. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You are listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. Now, that number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what is a ruminant? Well, the answer goes back to our buffalo story. A ruminant is an animal with four stomachs that chews its cud. And just in case you haven't been pondering who's who in the cud-chewing department, we're talking about, among others, buffalo, cows, sheep, goats, deer, llamas, and giraffes. Now, the buffalo was the big success story. It evolved on the Great Plains over the past million years. It is the only herbivore that did this. Well, of course, there were also fits and starts, what with ice ages, dry spells, and mastodons. But things settled down 5,000 years ago when the design had been perfected. The four stomachs, along with the cud chewing, digested tough prairie grasses. Now, in winter, buffalo feed themselves by pawing down through the snow to the grass, and in summer, they dig for water. The only serious threat was man, and we all know what happened. So the buffalo made way for that other ruminant, the cow, which has had the prairie more or less to itself for only the past 125 years or so. I guess you could say ruminants still rule. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Dave on the line. So, Dave, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome. What do you want to talk about?
I was at a friend's dinner party recently, and she served an octopus stew with red wine and flavored with rosemary.
Sounds great.
The recipe called for putting a cork in during the stewing process to help tenderize the octopus. I was simply curious about this. I kind of have a special interest in corks because my wife is a visual artist and covered her entire truck in corks. And so I know a little bit about corks, but not what qualities it may encompass that could actually help tenderize octopus.
Well, I think you've stumped the cook. I'm not sure. I've heard of this, by the way. I'm still delighting in thinking about your wife's truck covered in corks. Because we try to save every cork from every bottle of wine we drink, and we're now into, bucket eight.
Oh, excellent. Well, you're nearly ready to start covering some objects.
I'm thinking maybe, I have a car. Hey, but I've heard of this. I've heard it tenderizes. I have no idea if it's true. I have no idea what the chemistry is. But hey, what harm could it do?
Especially if it's the cork from the bottle of wine that you're using, it might even add some flavor. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, it can't hurt. Of course, one of the things that comes out of something like this is this idea of all the things that you add to foods. And when you said throwing in the cork, for some reason, what came to my mind is something I came across. I have a penchant for old cookbooks.
Uh-huh.
And there was a time in the medieval period where mercury had been isolated or people were aware of it, and they were telling you to throw it into a veal pie. I know, but think about it. It's silvery and it moves around and it's so glamorous and exciting. So why not eat it? It must do something good for you. I really don't know. But the real key with stuff like octopus, that kind of thing is that you either cook it for barely, a few moments, or you let it stew for a long time, 45 minutes, an hour and a half, to get it really tender.
Okay.
Squid's the same way. And if a cork helps it, use it.
Excellent.
Hey, thanks a lot for the call, and I'm sorry I couldn't give you a real answer.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
You take care.
Yep, bye-bye.
Goodbye. I've got to tell you all about something I just tasted. I had lunch at a restaurant in Minneapolis called Vincent. They have a dessert that I have to tell you, it's like a grown-up ice cream soda. Now, bear with me. It's beer and ice cream. And before you turn off the radio, it's this crisp, dry, incredibly fruity raspberry beer from Belgium, ice cold, poured over a fudgy, creamy cardamom ice cream. And what happens is, as you eat it, that raspberry taste keeps kind of going like a long note on the violin in your mouth, along with this cardamom fudgy creamy taste. It's delicious. Try this. Go out. You can find the raspberry beer is called Raspberry Lambic, and you can find it in stores. And I guess you could toast up some cardamom and stir it into some good vanilla ice cream. Just pour cold beer over ice cream. You're going to like it. Okay, let's get back to the phones. That number is 800-537-5252. We've got Purvis calling. So, Purvis, what do you want to talk about?
Hello, Len. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What can you tell me about sea salt as opposed to what's available? Like, I would use the brand Morton's or...
Oh, I see what you mean. Sea salt as opposed to the salt that you generally buy in the supermarket.
The granulated, yes.
Well, basically, the difference is that most salts are mined from land sources. There are salt deposits all over the world. You know, the old idea you'd hear people refer to a job that was really difficult was like working in the salt mines?
Yes.
Well, salt mines evidently go back a very long time. And sea salt is actually processed from seawater, where the seawater is put in shallow pans and allowed to evaporate. And what it leaves behind is that salt. Now, a lot of people feel that sea salt has, in quotes, better flavor. But the reality is that this is all about little microclimates. It's the little microorganisms in the salt that give it different tastes. So different seas or different bodies of water will produce salt that has different flavor. And you might like that better than the land salt, but it's purely a matter of taste. When you get into the Morton salt, you know, the salt a lot of us buy,
yes.
If it says iodized, iodine has been added to the salt. Now, certain people who really are into salt claim that that iodine gives the salt an unpleasant taste. This is purely a matter of individual preference, though.
I see.
Yeah, so that's the difference between the two salts. And, you know, sea salt comes from seawater. Other salt comes from land sources. But it all may taste different.
Can you really tell?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've, you know, there are those of us who are really fanatics. I've lined up different sea salts. You can close your eyes and put a little bit on your tongue, rinse your mouth after each try because you get rid of the flavor, and you will actually taste a slight difference, and sometimes a pretty distinctive one. So buy some sea salt and try tasting that against the iodized salt and see what you think.
I'll have to try that.
Do try that.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a good question.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Wesley calling. So, Wesley, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I'm interested in getting some initial information, maybe something that I can use, my family and I can use. We're wanting to change our diets and add a little more razzmatazz to it. We're not very savvy with the various spices and so forth that are available. So looking for some recommendations, both books or something on the Internet we can use.
This is a great question. Tell me kind of how you're eating now, because that gives me a good idea of what the starting point is.
Well, I'll give you a little background. I'm from a traditional African-American family. We've grown up eating a variety of mixed greens, vegetables, and were at one point pretty heavy on the fried food. Being older, I've learned certainly that I need to shy away from this fried food, so we don't do any of that now.
Uh-huh.
Most of our diet consists of poultry. We do very, very few beef, those types of things. An assortment of vegetables, cabbage, greens, mustard greens, collard greens, things of that nature. looking to incorporate more fish and the preparation of fish, as well as like to expand our scope in terms of fruits.
You know, you're already 80% of the way there.
Yeah.
I mean, really, because you're eating the greens. To introduce perhaps an Asian influence on your diet, there's a great book out there called A Spoonful of Ginger by Nina Simons. And it is, she's an expert on Chinese and Asian foods and on the healing ways of these foods. Because this is a very ancient concept of balancing your diet in a way that it keeps your body healthy. And the book has a lot of great simple recipes. The food tastes good and it's not, you know, it's not very complicated. So A Spoonful of Ginger would be one. There's another book out called The Healthy Kitchen by Dr. Andrew Weil and Rosie Daly. That's brand new. And I know Dr. Weil has a website, and he is a physician who is also into holistic medicine and definitely into foods that are healthy and good for you. So that's a great, that I would say look at his website. And it's Weil is spelled W-E-I-L. And then, you know, when you come to seasonings, you said you wanted to get a sense of seasonings and some new ideas. There is a wonderful writer. Her name is Julie Sani, and I think it's S-A-H-N-I. And she has done a book on spices, and I want to say it's something like Savoring Spices. And it's going to introduce you, like, for instance, she might talk about the spice cumin, and then she'll give you a recipe from India, maybe a recipe from North Africa, maybe a recipe from the Americas. So you get this variety. Mm-hmm. So if you go out and decide to try that spice, you've got a couple of dishes to try, and she's a great cook.
Excellent.
These are all people who test their recipes. So, you know, if you try one, you think you're going to really get something good to eat.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Hey, this is great. You know, it's so good to hear somebody who's doing this. You guys cook. This
we
is
do.
Neat.
Oh, I do. I'm the cook in the house.
Hey, Wesley, thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we've got Pat calling. Pat, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about herbs. And specifically, an herb that I planted. Thinking, I bought it as labeled as summer savory.
Yeah.
And now, 3 years later, I read that it's not an annual, or I am assuming it's not an annual. And I bought it because I was more curious. And now I want to use it if it's good to use. And then I thought after I wanted to ask you that question, I thought, well, maybe you could recommend a book to me that would cover herbs. From growing them, drying them, what part of the herb can you use? Can you use the flowers? How best to preserve them, either drying or in freezing them?
So you're talking a really good guide to herbs.
Yeah.
Well, yes. The savory that you bought, there are two kinds of savory. One is summer and one is winter savory. The only one I've ever grown is the winter savory, but I think they're both perennials, meaning they come back every year. Mine's very hardy, and it's a strong herb. It's sort of, if you think of a combination in taste of thyme and maybe an overtone of marjoram, that's kind of what it tastes like.
It's a wonderful, it smells kind of Italian-y, kind of.
Yeah,
It works with chicken wonderfully, but that's my repertoire, chicken.
You know, I put a few sprigs in roasted vegetables, you know, that I'm roasting in the oven.
Oh.
A few sprigs. It's delicious in vegetable soups.
Uh-huh.
If you're cooking dried beans, put a few sprigs. But the key is don't use too much. You've probably already learned this the hard way. I've learned it the hard way. Don't use too much because it's powerful. But it works with dried beans, any kind of beans, really. It works with anything in the cabbage family. It's great. Yeah. And roasted vegetables of any kind. And a few of those leaves over sliced summer tomatoes. Absolutely fabulous.
Oh, instead of basil.
Instead of basil, yeah. And when you say a book, I have to tell you what comes to mind. It's to me, it's the creme de la creme. It's called The Herb Farm Cookbook By...
Oh, they're just up the road from us.
Oh, are you lucky?
About 300 miles.
You're so lucky. It's by Jerry Traunfeld, and it has everything you're asking for and more.
Oh.
It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. It's called the Herb Farm Cookbook, Jerry Traunfeld.
Oh, right.
Okay?
All right, I will go and see if I can get that at my local bookstore.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
Bye. This book, the Herb Farm Cookbook, has everything you can imagine. I really think it may be the best book that's come out on herbs in a long time. It tells you how to pair herbs. It tells you, you know, flavors. What herbs go with non-herbal foods. It talks about what to grow, and it talks about almost every herb known to man. And then the bonus is this guy, Jerry Traunfeld, is a really gifted chef. And there are great ideas. My favorite part is herbs in desserts. He's got original, simple, exciting ideas. Consider this an unpaid-for ad for the Herb Farm Cookbook. It's a great book. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought. No husband has ever been shot while doing the dishes. Information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You're going to find it right there on the homepage. And there's new stuff all the time. By the way, there's that great chocolate bar that's up there right now. A person can always use some chocolate, right? Anyway, the proceeds go to support the show. Our program is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. The technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.